Questions Addressed, the 12th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on October 14, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week, we looked at Isaiah chapters 13 and 14. And I suspect that had we had more time, had I left more time, questions would have gone on for some time. So I want to allow for questions today. But the problem with a lot of questions at the end of a time is when you start the next time, those questions won't be there. So I don't know how many questions there actually are or will be. There were about five or six questions that were asked after time last week. And let me respond to those, and it will be maybe that will kind of prime the pump, and questions that you had last week that you didn't have a chance to ask, you'd have a chance to ask now. Chapter 13 marks the beginning of a different section in Isaiah. The introductory section is over. And in the introductory section, God is kind of making his case with respect to Israel and Judah. He's explaining why it is, what's wrong, where they've fallen short. And what's interesting to me is that the case is based on the fact that they have not recognized and haven't acknowledged the care and the provision that God has made for them. That's at the heart of it, is a lack of gratitude, a taking things for granted, and that from that then stem other evils, and he lists those. But at the heart of it, it's a lack of recognition of who God is and what he's done for the Israelites. As a result, then, what God says is there is going to be a period of tribulation for the nation of Israel, for Judah and Israel. Sometimes what he says is directed primarily at Judah, but other times it seems to be directed at both the northern and the southern kingdom. They are going to have suffering. And there are all kinds of sufferings that are listed, and it seems to be over a period of time, a protracted period of time, but that's not made real clear how long that will be and exactly what the chronology of that will be. But the hope of that suffering is that the people of Israel will come to recognize who it is that cares for them. That they will come to recognize God for who he is and recognize what he's done for them. And at the end of that period of suffering, there will come a time when Israel will play a glorious role in human history. That Jerusalem will be the capital of the world. It'll be the center of the world. It'll be the place to which people from all nations come for judgment and come for wisdom. So Israel has this glorious future that still awaits them. And that's essentially what it's talking about in the first 12 verses of Isaiah. It's laying all of that out. In chapter 13, then, it starts another section that goes for 10 chapters. And there are a series of oracles, or another word for that Hebrew word would be burden. There are a series of burdens. And I'm not sure exactly why it's a burden, but I suspect that it's a burden because it's bad news. It's something that the prophet is made aware of, and he feels it. In any case, they're called burdens, they're called oracles, and there's a series of them, and they are proclaimed with respect to the surrounding countries around Israel and Judah. The first of those is an oracle proclaimed with respect to Babylon, and so that's the one that takes up chapter 13. An oracle is proclaimed against Babylon in which it describes the destruction of Babylon. Babylon is going to be destroyed completely, and it will be made a wasteland, a place where no one lives anymore. That and the perpetrators of that devastation are the Medes. It says the Medes are going to come in and they are going to destroy. They have no interest in money. They have no interest in gold or silver. They're coming in to destroy Babylon. Then chapter 14, it talks about, it's a taunt that Israel makes upon the occasion of apparently the death of the king of Babylon. And this is in imitation of dirges, I guess, that are sung at the death of a king, in which typically what is done is the deeds, the accomplishments of the king are listed and praised, and all the good that he's done is laid out. In this case, it is just the opposite. It's all the bad that he has done, and it's talking about his destiny being to be in the pit of hell, and he will be forgotten, and his heirs will be destroyed, so that there will not be another king of Babylon like him. Okay, so that's essentially the contents. And what I argued is that I think that what's being said with respect to Babylon is something that is grander than the destruction of Babylon in 539. And the reason that I think that that is the case is basically twofold. There are several others, but the main ones are. We have these two phrases that are repeated periodically throughout the text here. One is in the day of the Lord, and the other is in that day. And at this point, my working hypothesis is that those are essentially synonymous. That's the first assumption. And the second is that they refer to a period of time in which God acts overtly in human history to bring about his final goals, the way he wants to wrap up world history. Now, when I say he works overtly in history, I don't think that that necessarily means that he acts in a way that violates the laws of chemistry and physics. I'm confident he could do that if he chose to do that, but I don't know that that's required in order for him to act overtly. What I mean by him acting overtly is acting in such a way that it is apparent to anyone who has eyes to see that God is indeed acting actively to bring about his purposes. The other thing that makes me believe that these claims with respect to Babylon extend beyond just the destruction of Babylon in 539 is that there's language in here that is overstating the case. It seems more elevated. It seems grander. It's overstatement. It's hyperbole if it's with respect just to the king of Babylon in 539. So, for those reasons, especially, I think that it's pointing to something else. And I think that it's doing that in a way that's similar to what I've struggled with earlier in Isaiah. And I will struggle with it more later. And you will see my struggle as we go through here. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how these things fit together. But if thinking back to Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah was told to give a sign to the king Ahaz, and Ahaz didn't want a sign. He said, no, I don't want a sign. I don't want to test God. And so Isaiah said, well, God will give you a sign. And the sign was a son that was going to be born to a young woman or a virgin, depending on the translation, and his name will be Emmanuel. And that is picked up on by Matthew, who applies that to the birth of Jesus. And what I suggested when we were going through that is that what was predicted to Ahaz was something that was fulfilled in Ahaz's lifetime, that there was a child born. It was born probably to Isaiah's wife, and that child was presumably named Emmanuel, and that child served the purposes that were laid out in the sign that was given to Ahaz. However, that sign that was given to Ahaz foreshadowed a more profound fulfillment of that same prophecy. That is, the coming of Jesus, who was more Emmanuel than was Emmanuel, who was more God with us than the child Emmanuel, and was born of a virgin literally, whereas the child born to Isaiah's wife was not born to a virgin. So what was the sign that was given to Ahaz is fulfilled more fully in Jesus. And what I'm suspicious of is that what was said with respect to Babylon, it comes true. Babylon is destroyed. It is destroyed by the Medes with help of the Persians. It is laid waste. It does become a desert area. It is uninhabited. It takes a few centuries for that to happen, but it does happen. And it has remained uninhabited to this day. That came true. But what I'm suggesting is there's a sense in which there is a fuller fulfillment of that yet to come. And I suggested what that fulfillment might be based on, and this is just looking out at the clues that we have available today, what might match up with what is predicted in Isaiah. And what I suggested is that what might match up is that Babylon is symbolic of the Western world, Western civilization, the epitome of man's attempts to gain control of the entire world. And we can talk more about that later. And that the Medes, then, who would they be? And I am suggesting that what might correspond to the Medes would be the Islamic world, or maybe it's smaller than that. Maybe it's Shiites, and I don't know exactly what to plug in there. But some part of either the Islamic world as a whole or some subset of the Islamic world. And why do I think that they might fit? It's because that is the geographical area that the Medes occupied, that their empire stretched over. And I find intriguing a couple of lines in Isaiah. The most significant one is 13:17, where it says, "Behold, I am going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold." That it's not money that's motivating them, rather it's destruction that's motivating them. And we could talk more about that as well. Now, in suggesting that might be where this would be fulfilled, I think back to reading The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, in which he laid out the whole scheme of what's going to happen according to prophecy. And remembering back to it, my recollection is he was wrong in several places. But I think it's the nature of trying to do that you're going to be wrong in several places. until it comes the point of time in history when those things are actually going to come to pass. That is to say that in 20 years we may look at the world situation and what I've just suggested would be implausible. That could very well be. But just looking at things the way they stand today, that's the way that I would match them up. But the bigger point, the more important point for my purposes, is not whether I have accurately identified what Babylon and the Medes would be, but more important is the concept that what is being predicted here in Isaiah has a more complete fulfillment in mind than just the destruction of Babylon in 539. From my perspective, that's a far more significant point because it has implications all the rest of the way through Isaiah, as we'll see when we get to him. And that's a thing that I at least am struggling with, and I suspect will continue to struggle with as we proceed through here, trying to determine whether it makes sense that some of these prophecies would have a fuller fulfillment in view than a more short-term fulfillment. Here, let me go through a few questions that were raised last time. Let me respond to them. One of them is, how sure am I? On the first one, that is, that there is a more complete fulfillment of this prophecy, I'm giving my odds 75%. On the second one, associating Babylon with Western culture and the Medes with the Muslims, I don't even know. I'm just guessing. It depends what happens tomorrow. The second question, is verse 14:12 a reference to Satan? 14:12, let me read that. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn, you have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. And I'll read 13 also. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. And we could go on, but is that with respect to Satan? Is that being said about Satan? I did a little bit of looking at that. The shining one, where it says the shining one, that was originally translated in the King James Bible with the word Lucifer. And so that's how that has come down to us, how that originated for us. But apparently, at the time, about the time of Jesus, about first century AD, maybe first century BC, in Jewish thought, they began to pay quite a bit of attention to biblical references to Satan. And this is within a segment of Judaism. There was a lot of speculation about who Satan was and how he fits into the Bible. And apparently they read him into this verse. And it was based on that, then, that Christian theologians picked up on that, and that resulted in the translation that we have in the King James Bible. I am not inclined to take it that way. It looks to me like this is talking about Babylon personified in the king of Babylon, that what's being talked about here is the whole spirit behind the enterprise that's called Babylon. And that spirit is one in which, and I think it's human society as a whole, working together, is going to become godlike. That Babylon is going to be a huge project to do what the Tower of Babel didn't quite pull off. And that's one of the reasons that I'm inclined to associate Babylon with Western culture, because I think Western culture, more than any other culture that has preceded it, has really taken on as its project to gain mastery over the world, control the forces that exist within the world, and shape it to our liking. And by some thinkers, quite explicitly so. So I'm more inclined to take this to be describing the spirit behind Babylon as it becomes developed in Western culture, rather than taking it to refer to Satan. It is interesting that the star of the morning, the son of the dawn, that there are similar terms that are used in Canaanite mythology, that those refer to the god Ashtar. And as I understand it, Ashtar at one point tried to take the throne away from the top god, Baal. And as I understand it, once seated on the throne, realized he wasn't up to the task and stepped down from the throne. If that's that is harder to fit that myth with what's going on here than if there were some attempt to actually take power and maintain power. So I'm not sure whether this is a reference to that Canaanite myth or not. It's possible. It is true that when it refers to God, it must be in 13 when it refers to God. The word that's used in the Hebrew text is El, rather than what is typically used in the Hebrew text, Elohim. And El was the word that was frequently used for the top god in Canaanite mythology. So Isaiah has borrowed, for this particular verse, has borrowed that title for God to be used in this context. So it does suggest that what's being drawn on here is Canaanite mythology, but exactly how that fits in, I cannot tell you. I don't know. Third question. What is the rest of Israel that's referred to in verse 3 of chapter 14? It says, "And it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon." So what is this rest and when is this rest? Was the question that was asked. With respect to the Babylon of their time, I think that the rest would have been freedom from the enslavement they experienced when they were taken into exile into Babylon and kept there. That when Babylon is defeated, they will no longer be kept there in captivity. And therefore, being allowed to come back, they will be free. No longer do they have Babylonian servitude. If we're talking about the greater fulfillment, I think what we're talking about is a period of time in which Israel rests from all oppressors, from all of its neighbors, that it has, and I would assume what we're talking about here is complete political autonomy, that it is no longer oppressed or persecuted by any of its neighbors. And when is that? I don't know. Is that in history or is that after we enter into eternity? I don't know. And let me make it really clear, I am not a student of prophecy. I'd like to know more about prophecy, and I'm kind of slowly doing it. But when I say prophecy, I mean the things about the end times. So I do not have a well-developed chronology or even framework for putting things in those last times. But I hope to build that up. But with respect to when on the chronology do they achieve that kind of rest, I don't know. The fourth question, If Babylon is symbolic of Western culture, then is Western culture bad? That is a great question, and that's one that we could spend a lot of time on. And it's something that, as a result of my readings and thinking about history at Gutenberg, it's something that I have tossed around quite a bit. There is a sense in which Western culture is a phenomenal development in world history. It is amazing. It is amazing how productive it has been. It's amazing how creative it has been. It's amazing what it has been able to achieve. It is amazing what it's been able to achieve economically, socially. There are all kinds of ways in which it is truly astounding. And in more recent years, there is a sense in which the United States has been right at the heart of that. And that's particularly true, I think, with respect to economic developments and the development of a free market economic system. That did happen before the United States came into being, but there's a sense in which the United States carried that several steps further. The same, I think, is true with respect to democracy, which existed before, but there's a sense in which the United States carried that several steps further. And I think both of those are quite remarkable developments. But what I have become increasingly aware of is those things are double-edged swords, both of them. Something that I, in my earlier years, did not really recognize and appreciate is that both a free market economy and democracy are, in order for them to work well, to be just, to even function well, logistically, requires that the society have a strong moral base. If you take that strong moral base away, then both democracy and a free market system become predatory, and they become ugly. Several of you have probably heard this, me say this before, so forgive me, but on two occasions, I studied in the Soviet Union before the fall of the Soviet Union and had a wonderful time on both occasions. I really enjoyed it. I was a student of the Russian language and Russian culture, and I really like Russian culture. I really like Russians. I find it they're a fascinating people who have suffered a lot. And because they've suffered a lot, there's a lot of depth there. And I find that very intriguing. But I remember thinking, when I left, especially the second time, I was thinking, this would be a fantastic place if it were not for Soviet power. That the Soviet power has such a heavy hand on everything that it just puts a damper on it. It makes life difficult for the people who live there. It even makes it difficult for people who are visiting there, if you're interacting with people at all. And so I was thinking, if you could just free this of Soviet power, this would be wonderful. Well, a few years later, Soviet Union fell. A few years later. At least 10 or 12 years later after that, the Soviet Union fell. And I was working on my doctorate and had to do some research in Russia. So I went back to Leningrad, or by then it became St. Petersburg. And this was just a year and a half after the Soviet Union had fallen. And it was ugly. And that came as a surprise to me. It was shocking to me. There are a number of reasons why it was ugly. It's always ugly when a social order collapses, because just the most basic things are not taken care of. A society doesn't function very well when all of its social order collapses, and it's hard to put that back together, reconstruct it. It takes time. So that was ugly, but that was not the most ugly part. The thing that struck me the most was that the Soviet Union was gone, and they were trying to build a new economy, and they were building capitalism. But as I saw what they were building, I didn't recognize it. And I was thinking about what's going on here, what's different? Because they're trying to sell things. They're trying to make things and sell them to other people and build up capital so they can make more things and sell more things. And isn't that capitalism? Isn't that the free market system? And what struck me is what they were doing was vastly different than the way I think about an economic exchange. The way I think about an economic exchange is you have more of something than you really need. I have more of something than I really need. Let's make a trade and we will both be better off. That an economic exchange is inherently a win-win situation. And if that is what an economic system is built on, there's a lot of goodwill that is developed there, and there is a lot of prosperity that is developed there. But what was happening in Russia was they saw every exchange as an opportunity for them personally to get ahead. And one example that I remember vividly, I've used this before, I know, but I went to a stand where this man was selling apples that he had harvested from the tree in his yard. He had put the apples in these brown bags and he was selling them for a certain amount per bag. And I bought a bag of apples and I got it home. And at the bottom were rotten apples and some rocks. Now, that is opportunism. That is not a win-win situation where I know what I'm getting and I'm willing to give up some of what I have in money in order to get what he has in excess, that is his apples. That's not what an economic system should be based on. That's opportunism. And opportunism doesn't foster goodwill. It doesn't develop the kind of environment in which there are more and more of those kinds of exchanges and an economy prospers. So what struck me is you've got to have a moral base that keeps capitalism and that keeps democracy within certain constraints. In the absence of those kinds of constraints, it gets really ugly. So Western culture has developed those things. We've spread them all over the world. But we haven't necessarily spread that moral base that's necessary to make it work right, to make it just, to make it a good thing. And furthermore, from my perspective, it seems to me that that moral base is eroding away in our culture as well. So, is Western culture a bad thing? Well, a lot of good things have come out of it. Absolutely, a lot of good things have come out of it. But it has all of the working parts of a monster. It's got everything the Leviathan needs to wreak havoc in the world, and I think that will come to pass. And that's what will be destroyed, I think. Then the last one, and then I'll turn it open for any other questions or comments. What do we do? If I'm right, what do we do? Well, the first thing is, I don't know what the time frame is. I don't know if we're talking 5 years, 10 years, 50 years. I really don't know. But I do think that we see the signs of God starting to move. I think we are entering into the day of the Lord, if I understand correctly what Isaiah means by the day of the Lord. And the thing that I look at as evidence of that, and I mentioned this last time, is the return of Jews to Israel. In my mind, that is a very big event. That's very significant. And it seems to me that that kind of sets the clock going. I don't know if that's the beginning of God moving or not, but it's the thing that I look at that I say, I think God's moving. I really do. But that doesn't help us with respect to, is it 5 years or 10 years or 50 years or 100 years? I don't know. But let's say that it's in our lifetime. Then what are the implications? What do we do? Do we stockpile food? Do we stockpile ammo? Do we head for the mountains? Do we head for the coast? What do we do? Oh, do we build a bomb shelter? And I have no wisdom with respect to those things. I have no claim to know whether you should do any of those things or not. What is more certain to me is that there is a kind of preparation that is prudent. And it's the same kind of preparation that God was advocating with respect to the Jews, the people of Israel. And that is, get rid of your idols. Whatever it is that you are looking to provide your salvation, whether in part or in whole, anything that you're looking to be salvific for you, get rid of those. Whether it's money, whether it's your status, whatever it is, whether it's your superior preparations for the end, that can be an idol as well. That whatever it is, that's got to go. That when it comes down to it, our salvation is from God and God alone. And that's critical. And I think that's in harmony with many of the comments in the New Testament with respect to the end times, where Jesus expresses the concern, will there be any faith left? And the suggestion is there won't be much. Well, what kind of faith is he talking about? It's those who are looking to God for their salvation. Those who are putting their trust in God to take care of them. So I think this is a prudent thing that we should all do, no matter how close we are to the end. That's something that we need to do. And I've thought about this because I too would like to get rid of idols in my life. And it's hard to sort out what is it that we hold up as idols? What kinds of things are we trusting in for our salvation? And there are all kinds of things that are potentially idols, but we've all got our own unique set. And I think that we are entirely dependent on God to help us to identify those that we have, give us the eyes to see them, and give us the wisdom to get rid of them and to learn how to trust him wholly, wholly in both senses. Okay. Those were the questions. So let me open it up for any questions or comments that you have. And we can go the rest of the time with your questions and comments. If there aren't very many, then I'll proceed through the passage. Any questions or comments?
I have three questions. The second one's a multiple choice question. The first one, the day of the Lord, Your working hypothesis is that it's a overt demonstration. You can tell me some more about that. Why couldn't a spectacular historical turnaround like the Babylonians coming out of nowhere, building a world empire and then trashing the Jews, why couldn't that be an overt? I mean, it sounds like you're saying it has to be somehow have some supernatural type dimension to it. Why are you concluding that?
I think that we see that phrase occurring when in context where it's talking about the culmination of things. So not just a spectacular defeat of the Babylonians in 539. It seems to be in context where it's talking about God pulling together the themes that he's been developing in history. Now, if I'm wrong that there is a greater fulfillment than just the destruction of Babylon in 539, then that has implications for how to take that particular phrase, because that phrase is used in this context.
Okay, that leads me to my second question, because that confuses me.
Okay.
It seems like we could have when Isaiah is making a prediction, let's say he's predicting historical event A, and last week I thought you were saying A is not the defeat of Babylon by the Medes in 500 BC, but it's something in our future. That's what I understood you to be mm-hmm. saying last week.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but that was so last week.
I know. Yeah. So this week, you seem to be saying, no, it was the event being predicted was 500 BC, the defeat of the Babylonians by the Medes. However, there's a more full and greater fulfillment to come, mm-hmm. akin to Isaiah 7. So right. that's what I understood you to be saying this
right.
week. Is that right?
Right.
Because it seems to me it has important implications, because if this is actually a prediction of something in our future, and we're talking about mankind being rarer than the gold of Ophir, that scares me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty scary.
But if it happened in the past, it doesn't scare you.
It doesn't scare me nearly as much. Exactly. So that's an important clarification. Mm-hmm. But then that's confusing, because the day of the Lord is in a prediction of back then, not a prediction of the future, if you take it that way.
Okay.
Right? I mean,
am I thinking
about that right?
I told you I'm wrestling with this, and you're seeing my wrestling happening. And we're in a new hold here, and there was just a takedown happened this last week.
Well, I'm just the judge.
I've been reflecting back on what was said with respect to the sign to Ahaz and Emmanuel, and I see these as being similar kinds of things. And the question is exactly what's happening in both of them. I think it's the same kind of thing in both. The question is, what is happening in both of them? Is it a prediction of something short-term that it foreshadows something to come in the future? Or is it a prediction of something? Well, there's several ways to put it together. A prediction, a double prediction, or is it a prediction of the bigger thing, of which the first one is just kind of a down payment? I'm not sure. I haven't decided for sure exactly how to envision the relationship between the shorter term thing that seems to be referred to and the bigger long-term thing that seems to be referred to in some way. You see what I'm...
Yeah. Well, the only one of those that I'm comfortable with is the short-term with a
with an echo. It's a foreshadow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't make sense out of double prediction. That just doesn't make any sense to me. But the short-term prediction with a longer-term fulfillment, I've often wondered whether Babylon in Revelation isn't something like Western civilization. So,
right.
I mean, it could very well be that theme gets picked up from something like Isaiah 13 and expounded and developed.
Right. And that's kind of what I'm working on.
Well, my third question is on...
And this is multiple choice.
No, that last one was a multiple choice. Oh. Well...
This is true and false.
I just didn't formulate it very well. So.
Okay.
The Lucifer thing, why? What about Babylonian religion? I mean, it would certainly make sense that the Babylonian king, just like the Egyptian king, would identify himself as a god, mm-hmm. think of himself as a god, mm-hmm. think of himself as a really big deal god, mm-hmm. and couldn't this language be arising out of Babylonian religion?
It could. The terms that are used and the actual words in the Hebrew text seem to be more suggestive of Canaanite mythology than Babylonian, but I don't know that the other is impossible. I don't know if they had equivalent phrases in the Babylonian religion to the Canaanite religion. That's possible.
Could you revisit 14:1? In light of what little I know about Western history and modern Western history, when Israel was founded and the Zionist movement, I'm trying to separate out the threads of how much of that effort and how many people involved actually cared about the Lord their God in their effort? And how many of them were just looking for a safe place, finally? Mm-hmm. And this runs through my head, too. Now, as we do the very thing Jesus warned us about, we're studying the Olivet Discourse on Thursdays, where he says, you know, earthquakes, famines, wars, and rumors of war, and all these false Christs are going to rise and say, hey. And they're sort of, he's sort of like warning them, someone's going to tell you that this is a significant event, and it's not. It's just another earthquake or another famine or another war. But they're going to try to ride. They're going to try to make their name on it. So ignore them. But that's what we just do. Mm-hmm. And so as I look at Israel today, would the ancients look at Israel today and say, that's Israel? Or would they say, that's a bunch of descendants of Jews occupying the land that we used to call Israel, but there aren't any Jews there? Not really. There's no temple. There's no worship. There's no covenant. See what I'm saying? And so when I look at 14:1, I'm just confused about who's Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is true that there are people in Palestine today who are descendants of Abraham. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones to whom God made promises. The fact that they don't recognize that, they don't recognize the one true God, that's another issue. But that there are descendants of Abraham to whom God made the promise that he would give to the descendants of Abraham that land, that they're there now is incredible to me. Now, that it happened through the Zionist movement, and the fact that the Zionist movement was not a religious movement. The vast majority of people who were involved in that from the beginning were not religious Jews at all. The issue for them was they had realized that if they stayed separate from the surrounding culture, they got persecuted. The Enlightenment came along and they thought, this is fantastic. The principles of the Enlightenment give every one of us an equal opportunity to enter into society and make a place for ourselves. And so they thought, this is fantastic. So they jumped in and became as secular as many of the people around them. And what they discovered is, as they became successful, people would point to them and say, but you're a Jew. They couldn't shake the fact that they were still seen as Jews and were still persecuted because they were Jews. So they began to look at their history and say, if we stay separate, we get persecuted. If we join in, we get persecuted. There is no alternative. We have to be separate. We have to have our own country, our own society. And that was the impetus behind the Zionist movement. So it was not religious. But it is curious to me that Jews worldwide seem to be taking a greater interest in their traditions. It's happening in Israel, it's happening in the United States. Where that's going to go, I don't know yet, but I find it interesting.
And you base that on what?
Just talking to people and observing. So it's what exists today in Palestine is far from what God is saying is its end. It's far from there.
So is that what, again, choosing Israel means? Making it Israel?
It's possible. But I'm, as I said last time, and I haven't changed my mind yet since last week on this particular thing, but I think that this is an allusion to the other time when God chose them, when it refers to God chose them in Egypt and took them out. I think this is another choosing of them, that is, God is renewing his commitment to making them his people in the land that he gave to them. So by choosing them, he's saying, I'm going to do it again. I'm taking you out of where you were, and I'm I'm going to put you in the land.
And does it matter that they are persecuted or despised or resisted for the right reasons? Should the world recognize the Jews as Jews and hate them for that? Or is it just hate them because they're successful, or hate them because they're in the right, the place they want, or hate them because they have a religious tradition that challenges their religious tradition for authenticity? And or should they be able to say, no, it's because they're Jews?
Well, if I'm understanding you correctly, I think the Jews have been hated in large part because they are God's chosen people. Whether those Jews recognize they are God's chosen people is another issue completely. But God has blessed them, and God has made them his distinct people. And I think that that's had several kinds of outworkings. And part of that's been a success wherever they go, to one degree or another. And I think that has aroused animosity, at least in part. I think that's been one of the causes for the hatred of the Jews. I don't know what all of the other reasons are, but I think it's because they are God's chosen people, not because they're so good. Is that what you were meaning? You would like them to be perfect and therefore be hated because of that?
No, I think it's, even as we see, and again, it's Revelation, about people being martyred for their witness to the Lamb. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't seem to me it would be right if it wasn't recognizable that the reason they were martyrs is because they were supporters of Christ. Mm-hmm. Not because they happen to be associated with this culture or this ethnic group. Mm-hmm. But by gosh, I'm going to kill you because you love Jesus. Mm-hmm. And you won't back down, and so that's a noble death. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, well, your family were Jews and their family were Jews, and I just assume that since you're pick a Jewish name, I'm gonna kill you. Mm-hmm. That it would actually really truly be because they were publicly followers of God, confessing him, confessing the Messiah, mm-hmm. and not just your average run-of-the-mill guy that happens to share a last name is recognized as Jewish.
Right.
I mean, does that make sense? Not that they would have to be perfect
sure.
human beings,
sure.
but that if they invested themselves in the covenant again, mm-hmm. it's because they mean it,
right?
Not just because it's tradition.
And I think ultimately that will be the case. But Jews have suffered a lot over the centuries, even though they have not recognized God for who he is. And I think that's nevertheless culpable. The king of Assyria was condemned. He was sent to judge the Jews, but condemned for doing so because he did it arrogantly. And I think that's happened time and time again, that Jews have been victimized. And on the one hand, that's part of what God was doing, but on the other hand, the people who are doing that are culpable.
Well, we do know from the New Testament that the great tribulation that's come upon the Jews is chastising them. It's mm-hmm. disciplining them. It's
right.
It's because they're his people that he's doing that.
Right. Right. And presumably in the process of that, they're learning, they will learn who God is at the end of that.
I really liked the way that you interpreted this passage. I think I agree with you, but I have one nagging question that keeps coming back to me when I think about this, and I'm going to try to say it in a non-convoluted way. It seems like what really comes through this passage and in a lot of Isaiah is it's dripping with pathos, and that pathos seems kind of intricately tied to it describing something that is non-historical. There's sort of these themes and realities that are universal. I guess my question is, could anything that is historical ever satisfy that? If all of Western civilization crumbled and there was hardly anyone left on the earth, 1,000 years later, would people look at that and say, yeah, that satisfies this prophecy, or would it still feel unsatisfied just because it was a historical event?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have wrestled with that as well. My working hypothesis on that is that what it's describing as having happened, or what will happen in history, is a reflection in the course of history of a more significant event that has happened kind of outside of history, and that's God's salvific purposes that he carries out in the lives of individual people. That there's a sense in which the same destruction of Babylon that's being predicted here has to happen in souls. And that's a more significant event in a sense. It's not as historical, but it's a more significant event. And history is just a picture of that same thing happening, reflected, mapped onto human history that happens in people's souls.
Thanks.
God said to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. I want the United States, a country that I believe has been deeply blessed by God with light and truth and the amazing parts of the Western society. It seemed like we were the flower at a point in time. And it seems like less and less now are we committed to sheltering Israel from her enemies. And I'm wondering if I'm reading this too closely. I too went through the Jesus Movement and Hal Lindsey's book, and I knew all the prophetic nuances and could recite them to you at a moment's notice. I'm not quite so sure these days. I mean, we are obviously part of God's plan. I'm hoping we are still something that is sheltering Israel and therefore blessing Israel. But I wonder too, other nations have sheltered Israel and Israel has looked to them rather than to God. And might God take them away the way he took other nations away, mm-hmm. so that Israel would be forced to lean on God alone?
Mm-hmm.
Would you?
Well, my suspicion is that is what will happen, is that all those countries that would otherwise come to Israel's aid will not do so. I think that it will be largely out of indifference. When I think back to Jesus' crucifixion, there weren't all that many against him, but there were a lot of people who were indifferent. And I think that's the kind of situation that Israel will find itself in, that it will be neither. It will be a small sacrifice that the world has to make for world peace to allow Israel to be destroyed. And I think that's the bargain that the world will make. My thinking with respect to Israel is, I think we should be encouraging Israel to play the role that God assigned to it. We should be wishing it well. We should be wishing that it would do well, it would turn around, and it would become the kind of society that God wants it to be. And we should really be on the guard against any sense of wishing it ill or being indifferent to it. I don't think that means that we can't be critical of it as a society. There's much there, I think, to be critical of. But as a whole, it should be constructive criticism. We should be rooting for it to be what God intended it to be. And I think that's critical.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.